However the McCleary decision plays out in the legislature, students and teachers have to come to grips with the new Common Core standards and how to meet them. Public education in this country has come a long way since the days of the one-room schoolhouse. Large urban districts like Seattle and Tacoma educate increasingly diverse populations. Rural communities struggle to attract good teachers. Dana Goldstein covers education for Slate and The Atlantic, among other publications. Her new book, The Teacher Wars, looks at the evolution of the teaching profession. Goldstein told me standardized tests are now not just the norm, but the organizing principle for most classrooms.
Only about one-third of teachers 5 years ago were teaching in a grade or a subject that had a standardized test associated with it. So the vast majority of teachers were teaching in untested grades and subjects. So that could be kindergarten, that could be art, that could be music, it could be gym. And what some school districts did, which I saw when I was reporting, is they actually started creating standardized tests in these non-traditional subjects. So I saw kindergartners and first graders sitting for a multiple choice test in their art class. I saw music multiple choice tests, and even in school districts where that wasn't happening and testing was still kind of confined to those traditional subjects, math and reading, you saw that the pressure to raise test scores was, you know, pushing teachers to focus more time on test prep. And in some schools, unfortunately, particularly the schools that serve the poorest children, test prep was actually becoming the de facto curriculum.
What does this say about the official government definition of public education?
I don't know if there is a definition of public education. And this is one of the things that the history really brings forth, is that we don't have a consensus in the United States about what public education is for. I think the assumption of President Obama's education reform agenda and also of President Bush's before him was that the whole goal of our system should be to measure kids so that we can then close achievement gaps. So if we can see the differences between how poor and middle class children perform on these tests, we will then have all this great information and we'll be able to bring the poor children up to the level of the middle class kids.
It seems like a worthy goal.
It is a worthy goal. But what I say in the book is that the assumption that testing would lead to improvement is like the assumption that buying a scale will lead to losing weight. So you go to the store, you buy the scale, you know that part of your weight loss agenda is going to be tracking your weight. But unless you start exercising and eating healthy, you're not going to lose that weight. And it's actually the same thing with education. You know, we can test and test and test, but if we don't actually change the quality of the instruction that the teachers are giving the kids, we're not going to see that improvement that we're looking for.
I'm speaking with education writer Dana Goldstein. So in general, then, in public schools, the role of an educator is to prep kids for the test? Is that what you're saying?
You know, our system is so diffused and decentralized that you can't generalize to that level. But I think, unfortunately, in a lot of urban high-poverty schools, unfortunately, that's becoming more and more the case.
We aren't New York or Los Angeles here in Seattle, but school administrators do grapple with this huge diversity of kids from a lot of immigrant backgrounds, a lot of income levels, and we are focused now on neighborhood schools in the aftermath of busing and the resegregation of a lot of our schools. So it seems like this is an onus to put on a school district to try to create a system that works for everybody and test it at some level, let alone do it on a national scale.
Yeah, you're right. And the challenges that Seattle is facing are really no different than many, many cities. Seattle's a mid-sized city, but the diversity of the student population, and I'm glad that you mentioned resegregation, that is a national trend. Our schools are more segregated today than they were in the 70s and 80s because the courts have allowed schools to resegregate. And what this means is that we have more high-poverty schools than ever before, deeply segregated schools, schools where over 95% of the kids are living in poverty. There's very strong research on this. We know that those schools have a really hard time focusing on academic achievement. The reason why is because the school becomes overwhelmed with the challenges of poverty that kids are bringing in. There are schools like that that are successful. Those are very inspiring places to visit. They are few and far between.
I wonder about something then to move on to the big granddaddy or the big It's not the big granddaddy, I suppose. It's the big kahuna, the Common Core, which is being implemented in many states, including Washington State right now. How can you have a Common Core nationwide when there is not a lot of commonality between locations in this country, let alone within a state itself?
Well, most other countries have something like the Common Core. And if you actually read the Common Core and dive into it, it's not the sort of top-down dictated curriculum that it's often made out to be. What it is a set of standards. So it says, for example, that the multiplication tables are something that third graders should know, that in middle school, in an essay, you should be able to lay out an argument and back it with evidence. But it doesn't tell teachers or schools what books to assign. I think that's something that could really, you know, change depending on the student population you have in terms of what literature might excite them. And it does give schools and teachers the freedom to work flexibly within these standards. I think, you know, one of the challenges with the Common Core is that they are more rigorous standards than most states already have on the books, and we've rolled them out to teachers and kind of expected them to pick up on them and implement them without a lot of support, without a lot of funding for retraining the teachers in how to do this. And, you know, we've had past efforts in the United States to dictate these sorts of top-down reforms without retraining teachers, and it doesn't work often.
We talk about trying to raise the level of education in America's public schools in order not just to keep up with our peer nations around the world, but to be the best. That's an American ideal. And yet, from reading your book and reading other things about education, teachers get the blame. They don't get the credit. They don't get the pay. So why would anybody want to be a teacher at this point in time, despite our stated emphasis on how important it is?
Well, when you talk to teachers, and there are 3.4 million of them, 4% of all civilian workers are teachers. It's an entirely massive profession. You know, they love kids, and most of them, this is the only thing they can imagine doing. It's something that a lot of them fantasize about being a child in the classroom themselves. And what inspires me is that even though the job is so tough and there's so much political pressure on the profession, that we continue to attract people who are very committed and sort of mission-driven to do this job. The argument I make toward the end of the book, after tracing this long history of teaching from the 19th century till today, is that we need to look more closely at those great mission-driven teachers, what they're actually doing in the classroom, because the best way to improve the teaching profession as a whole and to improve our education system is to look closely at what the most skilled teachers do and then have them work in mentorship roles to retrain and educate the novice teachers, the struggling teachers, to get them up to speed. We have so many ideas that are coming from outside of our education system, coming from abroad, coming from reformers, from the business world on how to fix schools. It ignores all the expertise that's already in the system.
Dana, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dana Goldstein's the author of a book called The Teacher Wars. You're tuned to The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.